bigger now. He could tell. They were spreading, tips touching opposite sides of the well, taking up all the space that he and Gulliver couldn't manage to fill. Pa. When would he feel the talons? Open your eyes, a voice said. That's the solution. The voice wasn't his. It was coming from inside the well, through his hands and heart and failed breaths. It was embodied as if from beyond. It was a girl's voice, one he'd never heard before. Virgil opened his mouth, dry like parched grass, to say, "Who said that?" But he wasn't sure he'd actually said anything until she replied, "Me." The voice breezed through the well like steam, drifting from a cup of hot chocolate. Virgil pushed himself back against the wall as far as he could. "I don't want to open my eyes," he said. This time, he was sure he'd spoken aloud. "The more scared you are, the bigger Pa gets," the girl said. "Besides, he's not as bad as you think. Most things aren't." She sounded so calm that Virgil almost believed her. She reminded him of Lola, even though she was just a girl. But where had she come from? He wasn't certain of much, especially not now, but he knew there hadn't been a girl in the well when he climbed down. "I don't believe in ghosts," he said, even though that wasn't true at all.
"Me neither,"
the girl replied. He realized now that his breathing had calmed, and he couldn't hear Pa anymore. But he still didn't want to open his eyes. What if Pa was staring back at him, widening his enormous beak?
"He won't be," said the girl. "Trust me."
How did she know what he was thinking?
"I hear by seeing," she replied.
Virgil unscrewed his face. His hands were making his ears sweat, but he didn't dare uncover them. He opened his eyes instead, slowly, slowly. Darkness. More darkness. But no pointed beak. No feathers. No talons. No paw. The well was just as it had been. His heartbeat slowed, still racing and ready for takeoff, but no longer desperate to crash through his chest.
"See?"
the girl said proudly. He moved his hands to his sides, slowly, slowly, and darted his eyes around in the dark.
"Where are you?"
he asked. It came out as a whisper.
"I'm all around. Can't you tell?"
Yes, he could tell. Her voice came from everywhere, like the well itself was speaking.
"Wells can't talk," said Virgil.
He placed his palm on one of the stones without moving any other part of his body. It felt like the well was breathing.
"I can see that you're afraid, Bayani. But you needn't be."
"How? How can you see?"
"I see by listening."
"My name isn't Bayani."
"It is to me,"
the girl said.
"Who are you?" "Ruby San Salvador."
The name sounded vaguely familiar.
"The girl who didn't know her destiny," she explained. "Remember?"
Yes, he remembered. From Lola's story.
"What are you doing here?"
Virgil's voice was small. Pa had disappeared. For now.
"Fulfilling my destiny," said Ruby.
"Your destiny is to live in a well?"
"No. My destiny is to help people in trouble."
Virgil clutched his backpack. Can you move the cover and help me up the ladder?
Of course not. You need arms to move things.
Oh, said Virgil. Silence filled the well. Gulliver squeaked.
I guess it's hopeless, whispered Virgil.
Oh, Bayani, Ruby replied. Nothing is ever hopeless.
Chapter 26 Interpretation of a Dream. It was true that Cowrie had studied dreams, well, on the internet at least. She believed the unconscious was a powerful force, quite powerful indeed, and sometimes the brain needed dreams to get rid of all the things that made people afraid or anxious. To Cowrie, the solution was clear. Overcome your fears, and the nightmares go away. After hearing the details of Just Renee's nightmare, she knew exactly what the problem was. It was clear as anything. When she was sure Just Renee was looking at her, she said, "You're afraid of girls in blue dresses." Renee tilted her head skeptically, then shook it. They were sitting on the Zodiac rug. The usual placements, Cowrie and Gen on one side, client on the other.
"I don't think that's it,"
offered Gen. Cowrie turned toward her sister.
"Excuse me, but you're not the expert here, and besides, how do you know my interpretation isn't accurate?"
Gen shrugged.
"Just seems too... I don't know. Too obvious."
"Sometimes the simple answer is the real answer," Cowrie said. She turned back to Renee, who looked unconvinced. "But I'll concentrate further, just in case I may be wrong."
She stressed the may part. She closed her eyes and pictured Renee standing in that field all by herself.
"You're scared," said Cowrie.
"You're afraid of being alone."
When she opened her eyes, Renee's face was knotted, like she'd just eaten something sour.
"I'm not scared," she said,
like it was a bitter word she needed to spit out.
"I like being alone. It's easier that way."
Cowrie and Gen exchanged looks. Cowrie wasn't used to being challenged by her clients. Then again, her only other client was Virgil.
"Well," said Cowrie.
She spoke carefully, pausing here and there to make sure Renee was getting all her important information.
"I could be wrong, but it seems to me that you feel alone, or maybe you're afraid of feeling alone. That's why you get scared when you look around and everyone's gone, because it's like you live in a bubble. Everyone looks at you like you're invisible, and then one day, you are invisible. That would be scary to anyone."
Gen nodded with vigor. Just Renee made a face that was a cross between a frown and a scowl.
"I like being alone," she insisted.
She crossed her arms.
"Oh," Cowrie said. "Alone is good. It's less trouble." "Maybe I'm way off. Probably because I'm worried about Virgil. I can't seem to concentrate."
Gen nodded again.
"It's true," she said. "She stared at those lines for a really long time before you got here."
She pointed to the star chart. Renee glanced at the chart, then looked back at the sisters. Cowrie wanted to explain that they weren't merely lines, but she figured it was best to leave well enough alone, as her father liked to say.
"Well," Renee said.
She uncrossed her arms.
"I can help you look for him, if you want."
Cowrie eyed her new client curiously. Renee was stubborn,
but with a quick fizzling temper. Interesting. She wondered what sign she was. Leo? Aries? Hey, what sign are you? Kauri asked. But Renee was busy standing up, so she didn't realize Kauri was talking to her.
Chapter 27 Valencia. Okay, so maybe being alone isn't always the best. It would be nice if I could go back to the days when I was part of a group. I mean, it's good to have the same people to sit with at lunch every day instead of just sitting wherever. And sure, it'd be good to have some plans over the summer besides feeding Sacred or watching squirrels and birds' nests. But it's not like I'm afraid or anything. Kauri says we should eat before we start our search party strategy, so the three of us go into the kitchen. I realize I'm hungrier than I thought. It's way past lunchtime already. Kauri pulls out a loaf of bread and some cold cuts to make sandwiches. I make a ham sandwich with mustard and nothing else. Gen makes bologna with about 5 pounds of mayo. Kauri has ham, lettuce, and tomato and cuts off all the crust. As we all munch on our sandwiches in the Tanaka's kitchen, which is big and clean and smells like potatoes with a nice table topped with tall, skinny candles, Kauri says that we need to start with the obvious places first. The only obvious place is his house, she says, her mouth half full. We need to go over there and see if he's home. That sounds easy enough, I say. I only used 2 slices of thin ham for my sandwich since I thought it was the polite thing to do, but now I wish I'd thrown on an extra. I taste mostly mustard and bread. But a sandwich is a sandwich when you're hungry. Not as easy as you would think, Kauri continues. She pauses. You're the one who has to go to the door and ask for him. I swallow. Me? Why me? I don't even know him. She takes a swig of her drink and wipes her mouth with her sleeve while talking at the same time, so I miss the first part of her sentence. I catch the tail end. He might get in trouble. Now I get it. If Virgil's parents think he's with Kauri and she shows up looking for him, he could get in trouble. Especially if he's off doing something he's not supposed to be doing. Where does he live? I ask. Kauri motions in a random direction. In a nice house on the other side of the woods. He goes to Boyd Middle. So do I say. I'm going into 7th. So is Virgil! Gen exclaims, a gob of mayo on her bottom lip. Are you sure you don't know him? Asks Kauri. I don't know, I say. I'm not good with names. I motion toward my hearing aids to explain why. Just faces. It's hard for me to make out what Gen says next because her mouth is full of food, but I gather that she's telling me what Virgil's face looks like. Brown, skinny, sad. I wonder how Gen would describe my face to someone else. I wouldn't want to be described as sad, but maybe I am. Not right now, though. Right now, I'm just a girl eating a sandwich, waiting to see what happens next.
Chapter 28 Bally. Virgil tried once again to shove the toe of his sneaker between 2 of the heavy stones of the well. But they were so densely packed that he couldn't gain enough footing to step up and reach the ladder. He also tried the ledge again, but it wasn't tall enough. Neither was he. He jumped just in case he'd suddenly sprouted 10 inches, but his fingertips never brushed the bottom rung. He wasn't even sure where the ladder was, anyway. It was so dark. He sat, exhausted, and fed Gulliver a dandelion. I wonder how long it will take for someone to start searching for me, Virgil said. He thought about the stone boy. How do you know someone hasn't started already? Said Ruby.
I hope they show up before Pa comes back.
Why don't you rest instead of worrying about Pa? He's not here now. That's what matters.
I can't rest. It's too quiet, said Virgil.
Silence is good sometimes, Ruby replied. That's when you're able to hear best.
Hear what?
Your thoughts, Bayani.
That's just it. I don't want to have any thoughts, because then I'll have to think about how I'm trapped down here with no way out.
Ruby sighed. That's the problem. People don't want to listen to their thoughts, so they fill the world with noise.
I wouldn't mind the quiet if I were someplace else.
Like where?
Virgil brought his backpack closer. Bali?
What's Bali?
I don't know, said Virgil. It's a place people always want to go.
His parents talked about it often. They even had brochures. Why? What's it look like?
Magical, I think. Otherwise, why would so many people want to go there?
Virgil imagined a bright, purple sky with thick, blue clouds. Anytime it rained in Bali, the clouds cracked open and fat drops of laughing gas fell down on everyone. No one could stop laughing in Bali. They drank out of golden goblets and laughed and laughed. They didn't care if people were in their shells or not. And the sun shone all the time, so the whole place was bathed in light. Anything the light touched belonged to the sun gods, and the sun gods never allowed any evil to pass through Bali's borders. There were soldiers stationed at every entrance just in case, but no one dared to step even close. The sun gods, only mortal enemies, were the 100 kings of darkness. But the kings had been banished to the core of the earth, where they'd been asleep for 5,000 years. The 100 kings of darkness couldn't sleep forever, everyone knew that. But no one knew when they'd wake up. So the sun gods appointed one special warrior to defeat them. The warrior spent years in training so he'd be prepared if the kings ever opened their eyes. All 200 of them.
It's you, Bayani, said Ruby. You're the sun god warrior.
I'm no warrior, said Virgil.
He leaned his head back against the stone and breathed in the mildew. He didn't notice it as much now.
My brothers, maybe. But not me.
Pshaw. What do you mean, pshaw? They're strong and everything. What's that got to do with anything?
Well, I'm just saying. They aren't scrawny and weak like me.
Weakness has nothing to do with how much you weigh.
Ruby hesitated.
Sure, maybe they can play sports and lift things, but that doesn't mean they're strong. There are many different ways to be strong, and being a warrior has nothing to do with size. Surely there have been small warriors before.
Virgil thought of Polito and the jungle dragon, which had been one of Lola's favorite stories before she switched to tales about crocodiles and rocks-eating children. The story of Polito had a much happier ending.
Tell me about him, said Ruby.
How do you know what I'm thinking?
I was listening.
But I didn't say anything.
What difference does that make?
Ruby said.
Tell me the story. I love stories.
Virgil didn't consider himself much of a storyteller, but he gathered all the pieces of Polito together in his head and began the best way he knew how. At the beginning.
Polito was only 1 inch tall, but he wanted to be king. Not because he was greedy or anything like that, but because his village wouldn't stop arguing and fighting over petty nonsense.
Virgil remembered Lola using that phrase specifically. Petty nonsense, because he had to ask her what it meant.
When your house is on fire and you straighten the pillows before you leave, Lola had said.
Everyone laughed at him. They said a man who was 1 inch tall could never rule a village. They got so worked up that they started arguing again. Gulliver chirped, so Virgil fed him a dandelion. He didn't feed him more than one at a time, though. Gulliver had to ration his food. Virgil wondered if he would have to eat dandelions, too. What would happen if he did? Would he die of dandelion poisoning? And what about water? How long could he go without water? Virgil put his hand on his throat. Suddenly he was very thirsty.
"Then what happened, Bayani?"
Ruby urged. "I hope that's not the end."
"Oh, sorry."
Virgil dropped his hand and scratched behind Gulliver's ears. "I'm not very good at telling stories, not like Lola." Thinking of Lola made Virgil sick and nauseous, like there were a million tears deep inside of him that wanted to come out. What would she be doing now? Folding the laundry? Ironing shirts? Pulling weeds from the garden? Fussing at his mother for buying too many bananas? Whatever it was, she probably wasn't thinking that one of her stories had finally come true. A well had eaten her grandson.
"Just try," Ruby said.
Virgil swallowed. While they argued, he gathered grains of sand from the beach. He could only carry a handful at a time. The village was so busy arguing that they didn't notice what he was doing. Then big ships came and tried to invade, but they couldn't get in because Polito had built a fortress, one handful at a time. Ruby waited.
"And?"
"And they crowned him king of the island. He was the best king they ever had." Those 1 million pushed-down tears crept upward. He missed his Lola.
"I'm no warrior. I'm no Polito,"
he said.
"Polito wouldn't hide from the bull. Polito was brave. He wouldn't be scared."
"It's not being brave if you aren't scared."
"Yes, but I don't do anything. I don't fight at all."
"There are many ways to fight. Maybe you just haven't been ready. But you'll be ready next time."
"I don't want a next time."
"My dear Bayani," said Ruby, "there is always a next time."
Bayani meant hero. Virgil remembered now. He sat in the silence of the deep, dark well, suddenly remembering things. One thing he remembered was the day his parents and his math teacher told him he'd be going to the resource room every Thursday because of his multiplication tables. Virgil's mind had wandered that day as he sat in the uncomfortable chair across from Mr. Linton, with his parents on either side of him. Instead of listening to the details of what made him special, he heard multiplication tables, and began to imagine a never-ending assembly line of tables, like the kind you get at IKEA, cloning themselves and stacking up, up, up. And he pictured himself standing near the bottom one, leaning back and trying to see the top of the IKEA mountain. Only he couldn't, because he was special. Mr. Linton explained to Virgil and his parents that going to the resource room meant Virgil would get more individual attention. It didn't mean there was anything wrong with him, Mr. Linton hastened to add. At the time, Virgil had thought, "That's not true. There is something wrong. I can't do my multiplication tables. There's a right way to do them, and there's a wrong way, and if I was doing them the right way, I wouldn't be here." But he kept his mouth shut. He didn't mind going to the resource room anyway. It's not like he was having a blast with Mr. Linton, so if he needed more individual time, that was fine with him. He was pretty sure no one would notice he was gone anyhow. Besides, it turned out to be the best day of Virgil's entire school year, because that's where he saw Valencia for the first time. She was wearing a purple shirt. Her hair was in two perfect braids. The hems of her jeans were smudged with dirt, and she carried a journal under her arm that Virgil was desperate to read. Sometimes he'd wonder, if she accidentally left it behind on the desk, would he sneak a peek? Or would he be a good person and guard it so no one else could? He liked to think it was the second one, but he really longed to know what she wrote and sketched about. It made Virgil want his own journal. Maybe he had things to say, and he just didn't know it yet.
"I wish I had a journal now," he said to the darkness. "I would write a goodbye letter to my family. Not that they would ever find it."
"You don't need paper to write a letter," said Ruby. "You can write letters in your head."
"What do you mean?"
"You close your eyes and mouth and send your thoughts through the universe."
"But how can my family get a thought?"
"They'll feel it, even if they don't know it," said Ruby. "Don't you ever just get a feeling sometimes?"
"Yes. Like sometimes at school, he could feel the bull nearby, even though he couldn't see him. Same with Valencia."
"That's the universe sending you a letter," said Ruby.
He thought of Lola, and how she always seemed to know what he was feeling. Maybe, somehow, she would feel that he was in trouble now.
"I think Lola gets lots of letters," he said.
"We all do," Ruby replied. "Some of us are just better at opening them."
Chapter 29. Valencia. 48 hours ago, I was just a regular girl observing wildlife. Now I'm walking with a psychic to the house of a boy I don't know so I can find out if he's missing or not. Life is funny, isn't it? Virgil lives in a nice neighborhood, just like Kauri said. The houses are twice the size of the houses on my street. When I mention it to Kauri, she just says, "Yeah, yeah, his dad's a doctor." Then she waves it away like it's the least important thing to be thinking about right now. And maybe she's right. I was just making an observation. To be honest, something about the big houses intimidates me, and I'm already nervous. I'm not shy or anything, but I didn't really feel like knocking on the front door of a house belonging to someone I didn't know. But Kauri had explained, once again, that if Virgil's parents or Lola thought he was with Kauri when he was really off doing something else, something he shouldn't be doing, then he could get in big trouble. "He probably isn't," Kauri had said as we made our way to the boys' neighborhood. "He's not exactly the type who goes off doing something he shouldn't be doing, just like he's not the type to miss an appointment. But you never know, people are an enigma." So here I am, and Virgil's house is one block away. Kauri stops me, and she and Gen give me very serious looks, like I'm a spy going on a secret mission. "Here's what you do," Kauri says. "Knock on the door and ask if Virgil's home." "Thanks for spelling it out for me," I say. When Gen giggles behind her hand, Kauri shoots her a look. "I'm serious," says Kauri. "His Lola is very perceptive. I think she's one of us." She puts her hand on her chest to show me that "us" meant psychics. "If he's not home, just say thanks and say you'll stop back later. Then we'll know what's going on one way or another." "And what if he is home?" I could already feel the heat of embarrassment. Maybe I wouldn't be so nervous if it was a girl's house, but the fact that it's a boy in a big fancy neighborhood makes my stomach flip around to the point of nausea. I don't exactly talk to boys on a regular basis, and I definitely don't go to their houses. "Then tell him to come outside and meet us," says Kauri, glancing over my shoulder. We'll wait right here. Gen taps my arm and smiles up at me. You don't have to worry that he'll freak out or anything, she says. Virgil's really nice, and he's shy, like I said before. He even has a pet rat. She pulls at the end of her jump rope and shakes it loose. It splays across the hot cement and dangles near the toes of her sneakers. Really? I say. This is an interesting development. Most people don't like rats, but they make good pets. Rats are really smart and curious, and they're always up for fun and adventure. It would be nice to have a pet rat. But I'd never ask my parents for one. I could just imagine the looks on their faces. Now Cowrie is tapping my shoulder so I'll know to look at her. She's really good at the how-tos, and at the same time giving Gen a little shove. It's not a rat, she says. It's a guinea pig. Oh, I love guinea pigs, I say. I had one when I was really little, but it died. Her name was Lilliput. I'd almost forgotten about Lilliput. She had very long hair, and it was all different colors, light brown, dark brown, and black mixed together. I can't remember where we got her because I was so little, but I remember feeding her hay and watching her drink out of the bottle in her cage. She died while I was at preschool. When I came home, my dad had already buried her in the backyard. I cried because I didn't get to say goodbye. Lilliput! That's a cute name, says Gen as she positions her rope for jumping. Lilliput is a name of an island from a book called Gulliver's Travels. In the book, the explorer, Lemuel Gulliver, travels to all these different lands after a shipwreck. The first place is Lilliput, an island where all the people are less than 6 inches tall. I liked the story, but I liked the name more. Lilliput. It sounded just like a place where little tiny people would live. I'm just about to tell all this to Gen and ask what Virgil's guinea pig is named when Cowrie starts waving toward the house behind me. Hurry up, hurry up, she says. We need to find out what's going on. All right, I say. I turn and walk toward the house. I try to walk all nonchalant-like so they don't see how nervous I am. There aren't any cars in the driveway. Maybe no one's home. I walk up the stone pathway. It's not like the house is a mansion or anything, but it's big. 2 stories tall with a garage that fits 3 cars. There's even a knocker on the front door shaped like a horseshoe. I lift it up, knock 3 times, and wait. I play with the straps of my bag. After about 5 seconds, I decide no one's home. In one way, it's a relief, but then again, it would be better if he was home, because that would mean that Cowrie's friend is safe and sound. Then the door opens. I know right away it's his Lola, which Cowrie told me means grandmother, because she looks about 100 years old. She's small, shorter than me, and really skinny. She doesn't smile. She's not exactly mean-looking, but not exactly friendly, either. She glances at my hearing aids, but only for a second. I say. Is Virgil home? She lifts her chin like she didn't hear me correctly. Her hand is still on the doorknob. Virgil? She says. For a second, I'm worried I didn't say his name correctly. Maybe his name isn't Virgil after all. Maybe I put the pieces of the puzzle together incorrectly. Yes? I say. It comes out like a question. No. Virgil isn't home. He went out this morning. What is your name? My chest and neck feel hot. My name? I reply stupidly. Yes, says Lola. So I can tell him you came. Oh, I clear my throat. My name is, Valencia. Valencia? She says. I'm not sure if she's teasing me or being mean. It's hard to tell at first, but then her eyes soften and she smiles. I was expecting you. You were? Well, I was expecting something. I expected her to say something normal, like, I'll tell him you stopped by, so I don't know how to respond. Your mother blessed you with a good name, she continues. Valencia Cathedral is one of the most important cathedrals in the world. It's in Spain. Oh, I didn't know that. Maybe your mother does. I doubt it. Lola looks like she's considering this. You should tell her. She might like to know that she picked a good, strong name. I think she knows already, I say. She's not the type to question her choices. Lola laughs. Her whole face crinkles up when she does. She kind of reminds me of a cackling witch, but not in a bad way. I like your mother, says Lola. That makes me smile, although I'm not sure why, because I consider my mother to be the biggest pain in the world. Does Virgilio have your phone number? Lola says. I will tell him to type you a message when he gets home. She motions her hands like she's tapping on a cell phone, and I realize she's talking about texting. I could have just said yes, but instead I blurt out, no, which is the truth. And next thing you know, she's waving me inside so she can write it down. I look toward Kaori and Gen and shrug. They're too far away for me to see their faces. Gen is jump roping. She's pretty fast, too. I don't realize how hot it was outside until I step into Virgil's house and feel the cool buzz of the air conditioning. Lola walks ahead of me toward a big kitchen. I close the door and follow. She starts rummaging through a drawer. Her mouth is moving, but I can't tell what she's saying because she's looking at the drawer instead of me. It's funny how people talk to things like drawers instead of the person right across from them. I don't want to bend down and stare at her face, because that would just be weird. So instead, I turn and look casually at this big bookshelf against the wall. I don't bother with the books, though. Instead, I stare right at a framed family picture. There are 6 people in the photo. 4 of them are smiling, big, shiny, perfect smiles. 2 of them aren't. 1 is Lola. She has a faint scowl on her face, like she's ready to get the picture taking over with. The other is a boy. He's not scowling, exactly. It looks like he's trying to make an effort to fake smile, but he just couldn't get up the energy. I know right away this is Virgil. And I know right away why Kaori's description sounded so familiar. I know him! I search my memory for his face, and it comes to me right away. He's in the resource room every Thursday, just like me. We never talked or anything, but he seemed nice, quiet. When Lola taps me on the shoulder, I jump. Who knew I was so jittery? She's holding a pen and scrap of paper and shaking it under my nose. Did you hear me? She says. She's asking me to write my name and number on the paper. No, I'm sorry. I motioned toward my hearing aids. There was a girl in my village who was deaf. Lola says after I give the paper back to her with my information. Virgil is going to be really confused when he gets it, but well, what's done is done. People talked around her like she wasn't there because they didn't think she was paying attention. They figure no use hiding our secrets if she can't hear us. But she heard everything. Lola leaned forward and tapped the folded corner of her right eye. She heard with her eyes. I wonder what kind of secrets that girl knew. I hear with my eyes too, I say. I know, Lola says. I can tell. And she winks.
Chapter 30 Smaug. There were so many things you could do with a stick. That's why Chet liked sticks so much. You could poke and hit stuff, you could swing it around like a weapon, but most importantly, at least for today, you could root out snakes. He hadn't seen a single snakeskin. He should have taken Davies with him and demanded that he point out exactly where he had found it. That would set him straight. Only Chet didn't want to share the spotlight when he captured the real snake. That glory would be his and his alone. He imagined just how it would go. Him tying the knot on the pillowcase with the snake wriggling inside, then carrying the sack home like a triumphant bounty hunter. He would insist on keeping it as a pet, and once it was coiled inside its tank, he would call Davies right over and show him what he'd done with his bare hands. And that's exactly what he'd say, too. I caught it with my bare hands. Chet wasn't so sure how his parents would feel about keeping a snake in the house. He could probably talk his mother into it. He seemed to be able to talk her into anything, especially if his father backed him up, but he didn't know how his dad felt about snakes. Chet liked to think his father wasn't afraid of anything, but he knew that everyone had their weaknesses. Even him. Chet would never tell anyone this in a million years, but despite being the bravest person he knew, he was afraid of dogs. Not little pipsqueak ones like chihuahuas. He could feed one of those to his snake, no problem. No, it was the big ones that made him uneasy. There were a few other things he was afraid of, too, like the fact that he might not make the basketball team, no matter how hard he practiced. He'd already failed at Little League, never hit the ball, not even once. And Boyd Middle School didn't have football, so that would have to wait. Basketball was his best shot at becoming an athlete. You might as well be nothing if you don't excel at something. That was one of his dad's favorite expressions, and right now, Chet was batting average at everything. Basketball could change that. The snake could, too. That was why he had a backup plan in case his parents wouldn't let him keep it. He would ask his father to take a picture of him holding it up, the way fishermen did with their big catches. Then he would text the picture to Davies with something clever like, "So you found a snakeskin, huh? Why don't you tell me the story again?" Chet mentally crafted a series of clever texts as he walked through the woods with his stick and pillowcase. He scanned the ground as he went, looking for places snakes might be, like big thickets of brush where it was easy to hide. "But you can't hide from me," Chet bellowed, as if the snake spoke English. He wondered what he would name it after its capture. What was a good name for a snake? Killer? No, too juvenile. Cobra? Too obvious. "Hmm," Chet said, jabbing a mound of leaves at the base of a tree. "Maybe Smaug." Yes, Smaug. That sounded both threatening and snake-like. Besides, dragons and snakes were probably related. When nothing slithered out of the leaves, Chet continued walking, yelling, "Smaug! Here, Smaug!" like he was calling a kitty. Each time he saw a pile of leaves and twigs, he jabbed and poked and called out for Smaug. And his heart didn't even pound. He was really made of some tough stuff. And then, swish. There was rustling in the leaves, similar to what he'd heard when he discovered that girl Valencia. He stopped and looked around. It was hard to tell where the sound was coming from, but he couldn't hear it anymore anyway. He suddenly got the distinct feeling that he was being watched by someone, or something. "Hello?" he said. His voice sounded weak, so he tried to give it more gusto. "Is anyone there?"
No answer. What if that deaf girl was hiding in the trees? What if she was putting a hex on him? He waited. When nothing happened, he rolled his eyes and mumbled, "Whatever." He poked the leaves with his stick and heard something, this time from the ground. He paused, poked again. He took a step closer so the toes of his sneakers brushed against the pile of leaves. He definitely heard something move in there. His body rushed with adrenaline. Goosebumps exploded across both arms, even though it was a million degrees outside. He tightened his grip on the stick and swept away at the leaves. He hadn't expected to find anything, really. Yes, he was on a snake hunt, but he'd been at it for hours, and now it had just become something to do. He didn't realize that he no longer expected to find Smaug until he actually found him. The snake immediately lifted its head. It was the width of a garden hose, but not very long. At that moment, Chet realized how little he actually knew about snakes. He knew how he would grab it, by the tail, of course, so he wouldn't have to put his hand near the snake's mouth. But he had no clue whether it was poisonous or not. Could snakes this small be venomous? How was he supposed to know? It probably would have been smart to do some research, but there was no time for that. He couldn't pull out his phone and Google it with Smaug's eyes on him. This was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. The snake was exposed, waiting for capture. The time was now. Chet's heart thundered. "Adrenaline," Chet mumbled. "Not fear. Adrenaline." The snake wasn't doing anything, just staring. Not hissing. It didn't sway back and forth like a sumo wrestler. It just rested there, head raised, almost like it was waiting to be picked up and petted. Almost like it was meant to be his pet. Almost like fate. Chet tossed the stick aside and flicked the pillowcase open with one melodramatic motion. He took a big, deep breath and moved closer. The second he leaned in, the snake reared its head back, and Chet wildly grabbed at its tail, which gave Smaug plenty of time and open air to swing around, one quick motion, and sink its fangs into the thick and ruddy skin of the bull's right forearm. It felt like the claws of a kitten digging into him. He knew what that felt like. His cousin had a vicious cat, but cats were one thing, and snakes were quite another. So he immediately dropped Smaug and howled, certain he would die in less than 5 minutes. His forearm turned pink right away. His skin burned. He imagined the poison traveling through his veins and attacking his heart. Who would find his body? That deaf girl? That retarded boy? And would they know how he died? If one of them found him, he'd at least like them to know that he'd died in a life-or-death fight with a vicious reptile. He cradled his arm and stared at it. The pillowcase was crumpled in the leaves like a deflated balloon, and he suddenly realized that he had no idea where Smaug had gone. The snake had vanished. Chet walked about 20 feet from the scene of the attack, searching for it. Then he sat at the base of a sturdy pine tree and waited to die. Chapter 31. Unpredictable Happenings.
"Virgil wasn't home, which means he's in trouble. I know it," said Cowrie. "We need to have the ceremony."
After they returned from Virgil's house, they collapsed on the floor of the Tanaka's living room to discuss their next plan of action. They'd also turned on the television, which had lured Gen's attention away. All for the better, as far as Kaori was concerned. Who needs the insight of a child where matters of life and death are at stake? Just Rene frowned at the TV and said,
"It's hard for me to make out sounds with the TV on in the background. Makes everything garbled."
She wiggled her hands around her ears as if this was the universal sign for garbled.
Do you mind if we lower it?
Kaori glared at her sister. Turn that thing down! Gen muted it, but didn't look away.
Did you say something about a ceremony?
Renee asked Kaori. Kaori's face turned serious. She straightened her back and folded her hands in her lap.
The ceremony of lost things, Kaori said solemnly.
It's a ritual to help us find Virgil, but we can't do it here. We have to go into the woods. The ceremony only works if you're one with nature, and this certainly isn't nature.
She gestured toward the television.
The clock on the wall, a hideously ugly and practical thing in Kaori's opinion, said it was 2:19. She wondered how long people had to be lost to be considered a missing person. It hadn't been that long, but a lot of bad things could happen in 3 hours and 19 minutes. Kaori anticipated just Renee's next question. What's the ceremony of lost things? Truth be told, Kaori had no idea. She was sure there was a proper ceremony that could help gifted mediums find lost items or people. She just didn't know what it was. No matter. She would figure it out as she went along. The ancestors would guide her.
There's no time to explain all the details, said Kaori.
She stood quickly and snapped her fingers in her sister's direction. Gen turned her head, but not her eyes from the TV. Kaori sighed.
Really, Gen was more trouble than she was worth sometimes.
Kaori had explained that television was too practical, too traditional, too everyday for the Tanaka daughters, but the poor kid didn't seem to get it.
Gen, said Kaori, get Mom's secret matches. We're going into the woods.
Mrs. Tanaka kept a box of matches in the second drawer under the microwave. She used them to light her secret cigarettes, the ones she thought she was hiding from her daughters. As if.
You can't hide anything from me, Mother, Kaori had once said. I inherited the second sight.
Inherited from who? Her mother had asked. No one on either side of the family has ever been remotely interested in such things. Mrs. Tanaka had no appreciation for bloodlines or former lives, the kind that stretched back generations, the ones that no one knew about. When Kaori imagined her birth, she pictured herself emerging from a patch of lavender, dark-haired and full of rage at the injustice of her past lives, of which there were two. The first time she'd walked the earth, she'd been in ancient Egypt. She knew this because it came to her in a dream. She saw herself slipping between the pyramids in a long white robe. What other explanation was there except that she had once walked through the pyramids in real life? In her second life, she was a freedom fighter from Bangladesh. She knew this because she'd once seen a snippet of a documentary on television, and when they showed images of Bangladesh, they really looked familiar to her, and she couldn't explain why. She probably could have learned more if her father hadn't switched the channel. She tried to explain that the documentary was necessary for her to explore past life transgressions, but he said it was March Madness, and past life transgression didn't happen during college basketball season. Just because her parents didn't know about her secret heritage and magical and mystical powers didn't make them not so. Besides, her parents had always been monstrously unimaginative. Take the smoking, for instance. Mrs. Tanaka smoked one or two cigarettes a week on the back patio, but she failed to consider that Kaori's bedroom window was usually downwind, which meant the smoke blew right by the spirit chamber. Clueless. Gen didn't make a move for the matches right away. Instead, she took her precious time getting up so she could catch the end of her show. She didn't get a fire under her until Kaori snapped again.
Life-saving missions don't wait for commercial breaks, you know, she said. Besides, we need to hurry before Mr. and Mrs. Tanaka get home.
Gen was still dragging her feet as Just Renee strode toward the door with her bag slung on her shoulder. Kaori snatched one of her mother's decorative candles out of the candlestick on the table, stuck it in her back pocket, and followed Just Renee outside. Once the door opened, Gen picked up her pace. She grabbed her jump rope and slung it over her shoulder.
"Why do you bring that thing everywhere we go?" asked Kaori. "It's not as if we're going to jump rope through the trees." "You never know when you might need to jump rope," said Gen.
Kaori rolled her eyes.
"Really, you are a wonder."
She took the matches from her little sister, and the three of them stepped into the blazing hot sun.
"It's hot," Gen said. "We should cook an egg."
She'd heard somewhere that it was possible to cook an egg on a car or cement if it was hot enough outside, and she'd been needling Kaori about it ever since.
"We don't have time for science experiments," said Kaori.
She locked the front door and shoved the house key deep into her pocket. Just Renee was already a few feet ahead, making her way toward the street.
"It only takes 2 seconds to crack an egg," Gen said. "How can you think about eggs at a time like this?" Kaori asked.
She and Gen followed Just Renee, who stopped at the Tanaka's mailbox to wait.
"I bet he's okay," said Gen. "He probably just forgot. What's the worst thing that could have happened?"
"You don't want me to answer that," Kaori said.
"Where are we going, exactly?"
asked Just Renee.
"Yeah," said Gen. "Where are we going with the mattress and candle, exactly?"
Kaori pointed straight ahead without breaking her stride, like a general leading her troops into battle.
"That way," she said.
As they crossed the street and entered the woods, side by side, Gen tugged at Renee's sleeve.
"Do your hearing aids hurt?"
she asked.
"Sometimes they itch or make a dent in my ear." "Hurts a little,"
Renee said. The trees brought much-needed shade from the heat. Kaori took note of their surroundings, thinking. She wasn't very familiar with the woods. Truth be told, they creeped her out. The woods were full of unpredictable happenings— snapping creatures, falling branches, stinging insects. She preferred the comforts of home, where she always knew what to expect. But what choice did she have? It's not like they were going to find Virgil hiding under one of the sofa cushions.
"Why do you still have to read lips if you have hearing aids?" asked Gen.
Twigs crunched under their feet.
"They don't make me hear everything clearly, the way you do. I have to fit the sounds with the shape the lips make, like a puzzle,"
Renee said, looking from Gen to the woods.
"And then I have to fit the sounds and the shapes with the situation, because so many words look the same when you lip read, like mat and mad, or pat and pad." "Were you born deaf?" "No, I could hear a little. That's how I learned to talk. But then it went away, mostly. I wonder if mine will go away." "Doubtful." "Could you read lips from far away if you had binoculars or a telescope?"
Kaori couldn't take it anymore.
How was she supposed to become one with a forest if Gen kept talking? "Stop asking so many questions," Kaori snapped.
She heard buzzing near her ear and swatted at it. Gen blinked at her.
"Why?" "Because it's rude." "Just Renee doesn't mind."
Gen looked up at their new client and tapped her hand.
"Do you?" "I mind," Kaori said. "We need to stay focused, and your prattling isn't helping."
Kaori didn't want to admit it, but she liked having Gen as her second in command, which meant she was always first in command, which meant she needed to be in charge. But just Renee seemed to be a natural take-charge person. She was leading